Welcome to Listener's Voices, the 44th episode of Listener's Voices, coming to you from KTWH live today, and I'm happy to announce I have a co-host.
Hello, good morning.
And
I'm Jane.
Okay. Thank you, Jane. This is not Jane's first time joining us, but always welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah. So we have, I always introduce the format of the show a little bit for anybody tuning in for the first time. We like to hear from our listeners, and so we throw out a prompt or a question or an idea every couple weeks, and invite responses. So we welcome them at ktwhwriters@gmail.com. It works to record a voice memo on a smartphone, if you have such a thing, and then send it to that email, or bring it in written, send it in, bring it in, slip it under the door in the middle of the night, whatever you'd like to do. Anonymous submissions are always welcome. And submissions to previous episodes, which we actually are going to start the show out today with some leftovers, our late arrivals from previous episodes. So, but first I will give an early heads up on the prompt for the next show, which will be 2 weeks from today. And it's a fun one suggested by a contributor to the show who, as it turns out, will be the co-host for that show and take responsibility for it since it was his idea. Yeah, Mischief of Our Youth, or Things I Never Told My Parents.
Ooh, that sounds tantalizing.
Yeah, and so we do want to stress that anonymous submissions are welcome, especially for this one, if you still don't want your parents to know and they're around or whatever. Yeah, youthful mischief. And that show will be pre-recorded, so we really would need to get submissions by that Thursday, which will be the 27th of March, and then it'll be broadcast on the 29th. But as always, if it comes in late, we'll just do it in the next show. So speaking of which, we have a late submission for the Hitchhikers episode, which was actually two times ago, but we had so much content it ran for an episode and a half. We had quite a bit the last time.
Yeah, this was a really popular episode for good reason.
Right. People have, and again, we always have to be careful to say we're not endorsing hitchhiking in this day and age. These are stories from decades ago that in the heyday of the hitchhiking era, when a lot of people were doing it, it wasn't safe then either, but at least a lot of other people were doing it, and was good practice for one's judgment of whom to accept a ride from or whom to pick up.
Yes, and it made for some very good stories.
It did.
In the future.
Mm-hmm. And if actually there's one I think I mentioned at the end of the episode last time that didn't fit in. I posted it on the website as a kind of bonus track. If we end up with time to fill at the end today, we may sneak it in at the very end of the broadcast. But first we want to be sure we have time for everything that is planned for today. So the first up is Becky, who doesn't have her own hitchhiking stories, but prompted this from her.
This is Becky in Two Harbors. The prompt this time is synchronicity and coincidences. For last time, it was hitchhiking. I don't really have hitchhiking stories of my own. But what it made me think of was how much I liked the book, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. That was a book that came out in 1979, a story by Douglas Adams that's a wonderful satire on life, the universe, and everything. I was introduced to the story in the summer of 1981 in the form of a radio play from the BBC that was broadcast on Minnesota Public Radio in several episodes. So when I think of the story, it is with the voices from that radio play. Part of the story revolves around a ship called the Heart of Gold, which runs on something called the Infinite Improbability Drive. The idea is that as this ship goes through every possible improbable possibility, it gets where it wants to go. And at one point in the story, it rescues our main characters, Ford Prefect and Arthur Dent, after they've been chucked out of the Vogon ship that they were trying to hitchhike on at an enormously high improbability level. Here's the voice is telling them, you have been rescued from certain death at an improbability level of 2 to the power of 276,000 to 1, possibly much higher. We are now cruising at a level of 2 to the power of 25,000 to 1 against and falling. We will be restoring normality just as soon as we are sure what is normal anyway. Thank you. 2 to the power of 20,000 to 1 against and falling. After more improbabilities, including Arthur having to fend off an infinite number of monkeys who want to talk about a script for Hamlet, the voice comes on saying 5 to 1 against and falling, 4, 3, 2, 1, probability factor of 1 to 1. We have normality. I repeat, we have normality. Anything you still can't cope with is therefore your own problem. It was a lot of fun to revisit this book, an old favorite. Happy coincidences, everybody.
Thank you, Becky. We both remember hearing that BBC series. I don't know if you heard it from the same source that I did, but
I think I heard it on NPR. NPR, it could have been one of the, it could have even been on KUMD. I'm not sure.
Okay.
Just playing it back, but
right.
It was good company. I was living in a little house by myself, spending a lot of time alone, but yeah. And you had the same experience, I imagine, or similar.
Yeah. Yeah. I was glued to it. I don't think I ever did see the book. So, Becky, being the librarian, the retired librarian, would be the one to have the book. Anyway, thank you for sharing that memory with us, Becky. Now, this one harkens back to the coincidence episode itself, and just a short little contribution here from Leslie, and then I'll follow it with my own short little story that it made me think of. First, I have to make sure that we stop and don't move right on to the next thing after this. So, okay, here is Leslie.
Hello, this is Leslie Black. I was married in 1969. Kenny Black died in a truck accident in 1978. Our son was only 3 years old. We were devastated. I was married again in 2014. I still adore my husband, Carl Zoritich. The coincidence is that they were both born on May 24th, different years.
Which also happens to be Bob Dylan's birthday, I think. So, yeah, quite a coincidence. And I have something kind of comparable to share. So I've had basically two significant others in my life. And it turns out they didn't know each other growing up or anything, but it turns out they had lived in the same house one after the other. And they did meet momentarily as the families were switching off.
Wow.
Both of their fathers were forest rangers for the U.S. Forest Service, and one was leaving a district at the same time another was coming in, and they switched households. And so much later, we found out that both of my exes had lived in the same house in succession. That's, coincidence. So, and also kind of along the serendipity, synchronicity theme here. This was recorded just last night by our volunteer Peg, by something that happened just this week. We'll hear about it from her right now.
Yes, Fran, this is actually a little beyond serendipity. It's sort of in a league of its own, the unexplainable serendipity. Or we'll just call it the unexplainable. I was in here tonight with Fran working on a show, listening audience, and so she talked to me about this. This happened just during the full lunar eclipse, just last night. And I had fallen asleep. I didn't even really have it on my radar, which is unusual for me because I pay attention to these things. I pay attention to the full moon and things, but there's just been, as life happens, a lot going on, and I just didn't have it fully in my focus. And I had fallen asleep, and I've got this nice big dog who usually sleeps well through the night, but all of a sudden at about 1:30 in the morning or 125, he came over and woke me up, as dogs can do, and he was prancing around. And usually what that means is I better get my pants and jacket on fast and get that boy outside. So I did just that, got dressed, walked out onto the porch, and generally if I do that, he's out into the woods to do his business. But no, he laid down on the porch, and I thought, that's odd. That is so odd. I just stared at him, and then I thought, huh, there's something wrong about it out here. There should be more of a moon, because I knew it was a full moon, and it was kind of dark. And I looked up and I thought, oh, my gosh, that's right. It's the lunar eclipse, and all... It was just, and I had no idea where it was in its progression. I had completely forgotten this thing had occurred. And I thought, oh my gosh, my dog woke me up and got me out on my porch right on time, just before there was a little of the bright white, you know, and I didn't even know which direction it was going. And I realized as I stood there staring at it, that it soon became completely covered and turned into this big orange globe. And so now I'm up intermittently looking at it till like 3 in the morning and a little after until it started showing its whiteness again on the other side. But I wouldn't have seen any of that if it wouldn't have been for Cooper, who was just laying there on the porch, very content, never had any desire to go into the yard. Until, of course, I wanted to go in about 3 in the morning, and then he decided to do that. But that's different. That was the unexplainable and amazing and really something I'll never forget.
What a great story.
Oh, it's great. Yeah, animals can sometimes sense things that we can't even sense.
Yeah.
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 In nature.
Unexplainable. He was sleeping on the bed with her. It wasn't like he was... exposed to the south side of the house. It has a window out that the difference in moonlight would have been especially noticeable.
Well, thanks for that, Peg.
Thank you so much. Yep, I'm glad you happened to be here last night so we could document that. And I just wanted to share a line from, this is from a video on the Internet Archive, relating to synchronicity and it's a quote from Greg Lavoie. When you're on the right path, the universe winks and nods at you from time to time to let you know. And then, according to Carl Jung, this is that these clues are synchronicity or meaningful coincidence. That's kind of a nice way to put it. That's kind of the feeling that you get when things like that happen, that you're on the right path, the universe winks and nods at you from time to time. So that kind of winds up that episode, the last one, although, as we always say, you're still welcome to send in submissions about synchronicity, coincidences, or serendipity. But moving into the subject of the week, have we even announced that yet this time? I don't think we did.
Oh, you better announce it, Frank,
okay.
Right now.
Privacy or personal space. And... and also kind of merging that into the idea of hermitage, the way of life of hermits. So to introduce the whole concept, we so take for granted culturally, we'll address that a little later, but I asked Jane to share this story we found on the Internet. This is a short little blurb here.
When I was in sixth grade, I had a friend who was curious about her parents' liquor cabinet. One day in class, she tried to pass me a note inviting me to come over and sample their booze while they were out. But our teacher intercepted the note. Concerned about the delinquent behavior my friend described, she immediately contacted our parents. My dad was on his way to the school, she told me. I didn't even know what the note said, but I knew I was in big trouble. When my dad got to the classroom, he asked my teacher to step out into the hall. I was trembling in my seat. A few minutes later, the teacher returned and continued our lesson. My dad left without saying a word to me. My thoughts raced. What had happened? That evening, when he got home from work, my dad pulled me aside for a talk. He told me what the note had said, but the message was not his primary concern. He explained that the note was a private correspondence between my friend and me. The teacher had invaded my privacy, and that was not acceptable. Until that moment, I'd had no idea that I had a right to privacy.
I love that story. It shows...
Yeah, it's such a different side to what privacy is, and the idea that it's with a young person. We don't think of that so often.
Right.
With parenting.
How you acquire your sense of privacy, mm-hmm. and which obviously hadn't occurred to her or been demonstrated or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, when we talk a little later about some other cultural approaches to privacy, that's something to bear in mind.
Sure.
How do these things get instilled in our minds? So I think next up we are going to hear from Richmond with his experience in seeking privacy for a certain purpose.
Hello, fellow listeners. This is Richmond, responding to the KTWH Listener's Voices prompt, Privacy or Personal Space. Early March 2025, I took a drive, northbound on Highway 2 out of Two Harbors, not sure how far up, to the narrow dirt road, taking a right-hand turn, now heading eastbound on the Alger Grade. Remember a right-hand turn? That phrase goes back before turn signals to the time when we signaled a turn by a hand gesture placed outside the vehicle window. Oh my, how far we have progressed. I'd intended to park in the North Shore Trail snowmobile parking lot. Last fall, a year ago, I'd driven up there and parked to watch a splendid display of northern lights. The parking lot was not lit. There were no other vehicles. Looking up at the ribbons of color drifting along the edge of the Milky Way, I felt a sense of awe and the comfort of privacy. Tonight, as I pulled into that same parking lot, it was brightly lit by some sort of super luminous yard light type thing, and there were a couple of cars parked as well. My heart sank a bit as I was hoping for more privacy. Leaving the lot and light, I continued eastbound on the Alger Grade. The gravel road, woods of what appeared to be poplar on either side, the road being wide enough for the width of two cars, but not much more. At least, that's how it appeared while driving through the night. No houses, no barns, no fences, no vehicles, no humans. What there was a crisp, clear, 28-degree Fahrenheit March atmospheric winter dark sky, lit up with a spacious array of constellations and a slice of crescent moon with a thread of light to circle the whole of it, holding in the darkness. I pulled on to the side of the road and stepped out onto the vacant dirt. No one there but the moon, stars, and privacy. Getting back on to the Alger Grade, heading eastbound, a mile or so further, the occasional house, fences, lights, a barn, and then the human homes more frequent. There were signs on the gates and fences, private land, no trespassing. Not such a great spot to pull over and look up at the cosmos.
these folks wanted their privacy as well. I made a U-turn onto a driveway of some residence. It was not posted as private, so I figured it was okay. Driving back to my original point of solitude, parking, getting out of my car, looking once again up to the galaxy of stars, crescent moon hanging out with Venus over the western horizon, privacy and solitude. There's some sort of equivalency here to having personal space. Preferences for privacy and personal space. It varies by culture, clan, individual, time, and place. Some find comfort in a crowd. Others seek the solitude of stars. By the way, this blissful consummation of privacy, solitude, moon, stars, shifted abruptly as behind me, about a quarter mile back, approaching fast, were the bright white and amber lights of a large vehicle. Now, remembering the narrow width of road, time for me to go rolling home, bringing with me a memory of the moment, a peaceful, easy feeling of privacy and solitude. Like the lyrics from the Eagles song, I get a peaceful, easy feeling, and I know you won't let me down, 'cause I'm already standing on the ground.
I know you won't let me down, 'cause I'm already standing on the ground.
Thank you, Richmond. Yeah, solitude, another aspect of this subject, which can go either way, as we may get to later.
Yes, and I'm thinking about the idea of privacy, private, keep out. And that was a wonderful juxtaposition.
Uh-huh,
I loved it.
Right, yeah. Yep, exactly. So our only other submission, let's see, when did I think I would interject mine? I guess now. Yeah, I guess before we get to the next recorded submission we had, I'm going to share this. So that means I'm going to put my reading glasses on. Okay, well, back in the 1980s, I was spending a few weeks as a guest at a Korean Buddhist hermitage for women monks. I call them monks because their role in the Buddhist institution there is virtually the same as the men's role, not differentiated like priests and nuns in the Catholic Church. So one day, one of the young monks there was taking me up to visit a famous, highly respected, and nationally renowned male monk who lived up the mountain in his own small hermitage. It was a short hike up the trail, maybe 20 minutes or so. The visit probably had something to do with his official approval of the Buddhist name which my women friends at the hermitage had bestowed on me. But when we arrived, he was not there. Although he would have had an attending young monk or two living there with him, no one else was there at the same time either. But that didn't stop us from inviting ourselves into his room in his absence. I was surprised. It never would have occurred to me to even open the sliding paper and wood door to peek in, much less to enter the room. My young monk escort didn't stop there. She took a good look around at everything he had in his room, which, granted, wasn't so much. Buddhist monks, at least at that time, lived a pretty Spartan life, and their rooms were wonderfully bare of any unnecessary frivolities or gadgets, or what we now call devices. Just books and a low table, at which the monk and his guests would sit, cross-legged on the floor, to drink tea. After having taken stock of his visible worldly possessions, she proceeded to open closet and storage space doors to see what he had stashed away there. Jane's giving me a look of surprise. I was quite taken aback and embarrassed. It wasn't quite like being in the Pope's private quarters, but almost, maybe a cardinal's. What if someone came in and found us poking into his private spaces? I don't recall how the situation resolved itself. Did we give up and come back another time, or was it later that visit when he finally showed up? I do remember the audience with him. being jabbed in the ribs by my escort's elbow when I unknowingly used a low form of Korean speech, which is supposed to be reserved for one's juniors or inferiors, when telling him that I had already been to Korea many times. He took it with a straight face, but I'm sure he was having a good chuckle about it to himself. Maybe he even shared the story later with others about the clueless foreigner who didn't know how to speak properly to an elder. I don't know if this particular invasion of privacy is something most Koreans would not have thought twice about, but I had learned by then that Koreans' sense of privacy is not nearly as refined as ours. While staying at that hermitage and other places in Korea, people would just walk into what I would consider my private space, usually a bedroom, unannounced and without apology. There were times at the hermitages and temples when I was obliged to share my space during special events with hundreds of lay people who would move in for a night or two. We all slept on the floor in most places at that time. There are a lot of beds showing up in Korean homes and things now, but at this time, pretty much everybody slept on the floor all the time, a heated floor, so it was lovely, really. Anyway, getting back to my narrative here. We all slept on the floor, and the available floor space in my small room, maybe 10 feet square, would be completely covered with bodies, shoulder to shoulder. One night, in the middle of the night, I got up to use the outdoor facility, and by the time I got back, another woman was already asleep in my space. As I recall, I was already sharing that space with only two or three other women, so it was possible for me to find floor space still, though it was tight. It reminded me of that Simon and Garfunkel song. Did that come to mind for you at all, Jane? Okay. I get up to wash my face. When I come back to bed, someone's taken my place. It came to mind immediately.
More.
Personal space is certainly defined differently there, too, if the notion even exists. Public transportation can be so packed, they used to have women employed to help push a few more bodies onto the bus before the door closed. My friend, whom I consulted last night to be sure I hadn't made that up about the body pushers, assured me it was true, and added, "I don't remember seeing any signs that the pressed felt oppressed." He also sent a photo from probably the 60s or 70s that I will post on the website with this episode of a woman pushing people into the bus. It's classic. Anyway, where am I here? People just expected it. And it would be, they were totally used to it. It could be packed literally sardine can tight. That's true of buses and subway cars. I'm not sure if they have, I don't think I've ever seen anybody packing people into the subway cars, but apparently they may do that in Japan. And waiting lines could be practically toe to heel with the person in front of you. That is contrasted with scenes I observed, for example, in the post office here in Two Harbors, well before COVID. I remember going through the entry door, and although there were only two other customers in the inner area, having to practically keep my back on the inner door because the first person waiting was standing at least 5 feet behind the person who was being served at the counter. 5 feet. They would have to take a step to the side to be sure to keep 5 feet from me backed up against the door. I observed cases like this many times before COVID. Must be the Scandinavian genes in this area, perhaps. My Korea consultant also reminded me of Koreans' apparent disdain for solitude. As he put it, quote, "If you ever got caught being in your room by yourself, you were considered lonely and in need of company," end quote. Maybe that explains a lot of my unsolicited visitors.
Oh, that's really interesting. The idea that you'd strive for the lack of solitude.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the beds. I mean, that's a wonderful story. You know, it is such a contrast with our, you know, personal space taken to the nth degree. Yeah. And just, did I miss where this was, where this took place?
In Korea.
At a Buddhist hermitage.
Well, in temples. Yeah. The places that would have these hundreds of visitors suddenly for a couple of nights would be a larger temple.
Oh, what an experience, Fran.
Let's see. Yeah, the first story of going up to visit the monk whose place we raided, thoroughly searched.
Yes, raided.
Yeah, that was at a small women's hermitage. And then we went up Mountainside to visit him at his. Yeah. Yeah. So, and you've lived in Australia for many years.
Yes, and something that I noticed here, and when I was thinking about the idea of privacy, is there are, in the neighborhoods, there are brush fences or tall fences around nearly every house. And they're right, they go right up to the footpath in most instances. And so you're never aware of what's going on in the backyard, which is kind of where everything happens. And that was hard for me culturally. It felt lonely. And I would contrast it with the idea of you would never see, a stretch of beautiful old houses along like London Road with massive yards that merge into one another. You would never see that in Australia, at least in my experience in Melbourne and Adelaide.
Interesting.
Like big brush fences, tall.
And in Korea, I'm thinking of the countryside, and again, I haven't been there for over 10 years, so some of these observations are no doubt dated. They invariably in the countryside anyway would have stone walls or brush fences perhaps around each little individual compound and walling off your space. So they definitely had that sense of boundaries and keeping the family together and private. I think it's time to merging the prompt into the idea of hermitage as well. And this is another beautiful word, graced with another submission from Patrick Eller. This is probably another of his from several years ago that he is sharing with us now.
So unnoticed by all his neighbors. He is the neighborhood hermit. He does not bother them, so they leave him alone to live in his two-room house on that last three undeveloped acres along the banks of a small, lazy river. A river where the willows reach down to touch the muddy floor. Cottonwoods spread their downy seed like a carpet on the surface of the water, and it gathers and swirls above the deep holes before the rapids that sing like chimes. On a warm summer day, you may be startled to notice a soiled, broad-brimmed hat rise up from this living marriage of nature and intention. And then you might feel the unassuming scrutiny of those steel blue eyes. And if his glance makes you uneasy, that is not because that is what he intends. He just pays attention to the things that are close by. He is as curious as a raven. He's trying to judge the intentions of whatever distraction may have drawn him away from his work. Just like that, he will disappear into the greenery. And you may well wonder if you saw him at all. You may find it hard to remember anything about him except the slow, calm knowledge and the privacy of those blue eyes. He is someone's brother, someone's great uncle. He is someone's son. But none of them know him anymore. Moved to this place on the river long before the expensive homes that now surround his 3 acres were ever dreamed of, long before the road was paved and the manicured lawns with winding driveways closed in around him. He has long been the steward of this small piece of earth. With patient observation and slow effort, they have grown together. Together, they quietly flourish. Of course, I've been often offered large sums of money by those who had bought up his neighbors. He always made it clear from the start that he would not sell his home, and then he would politely lead them to the gate. He belongs to this place as much as it is his. The roots are deep. They are entwined with all that they are together. Might just as well have asked him to sell an arm or a leg, but what price for his heart? He often thinks back of his life before he came to this place. He remembers coming home from the war to end all wars, the restlessness that took him on the road from Northwest to Washington State, where he logged big timber on steep slopes. Then joining the Wobblies strike in Everett, he was shot in the arm by a hired thug during a bitter face-off. It always seemed a sad irony that after 3 years in Europe fighting for his country, he came home unharmed, only to be sorely wounded in his own nation. Well, that wound drove him east to work for the Great Northern Railway. He was a brakeman working from Montana to Minnesota, until one day he witnessed an injustice imposed on a hobo, and he intervened. He got in a fight with his conductor, and he lost his job. After that, he wandered the Great Plains with the seasons, working as a farmhand and carpenter, until he saved the money to buy his own place on earth along the Slazy River, where every year he plants a new garden, and he lives out his quiet life. These surrounding days are the nutrition of all those moments that brought him here. A million moments that finally revealed to him just where he could place his faith. Clearly revealed to him what deserved his belief and effort. Showed him what was worthy of his trust. And his trust is deep with all those roots, and his efforts are strengthened by that depth. And his faith is rewarded by seeing that bounty return year after year. And the new neighbors see it too. And they think it's quaint and curious, but they have no idea of the seeds from which it all grows. To the neighbors, he is an eccentric hermit with a green thumb on a valuable piece of real estate. Suppose that someday someone will notice that they have not seen the old man lately. Maybe the mailman will notice that his box has not been checked for longer than usual. Or someone will see that no smoke is rising from the chimney on a cold winter morning. Someone will have to be sent to knock on a heavy wooden door. When there is no answer, they will find it necessary to go inside. And they will find that he has passed beyond the concerns of this world like the changing seasons, just as naturally and unnoticed as the day that autumn turns to winter. And then a new winding driveway, a manicured lawn, and an expensive house will make the neighborhood a uniform whole. And there will be no one left to wonder about the hermit and his flowers placed between the berries and vegetables, or how they all came to be on the banks of that ever-changing river.
Thank you, Patrick. That's so beautiful and sad at the same time. I wish I'd had a chance or taken the chance. Next time we're together, Patrick, I'm going to ask you about the derivation of that story.
Yes. Is it someone you knew or is it something you thought up? It's excellent.
Certainly.
And the music?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Great touch. Very nice. And perfect song.
Mm-hmm. So, expanding on the idea of hermitage, I found this short little poem. I can't even remember it now. It was a couple of days ago I found it. It's less than a minute long, so we'll hear George William Russell, who lived from 1867 to 1935.
The Hermit by George William Russell, read for LibriVox.org by Ed Weymouth. Now the quietude of earth nestles deep my heart within. Friendships new and strange have birth since I left the city's din. Here the tempest stays its guile, like a big kind brother plays, romps and pauses here a while from its immemorial ways. Now the silver light of dawn, slipping through the leaves that fleck my one window, hurries on, throws its arms around my neck. Darkness to my doorway hies, lays her chin upon the roof, and her burning seraph eyes now no longer keep aloof. And the ancient mystery holds its hands out day by day, takes a chair and croons with me by my cabin built of clay. When the dusky shadow flits by the chimney nook, I see where the old enchanter sits, smiles and waves, and beckons me. End of poem. This recording is in the public domain.
Oh, that's a find.
It's a find,
real
yes.
Find.
I know.
That's beautiful.
I thought I had written this line from it that I liked so well. That was something about the ancient mystery holds its hand out and takes a seat. And yeah, so concise and really beautiful. So here's a piece by Samuel Barber, who did a series of hermit songs. And this one is called The Monk and His Cat, although the narrator of the song refers to himself as the scholar and cat. And it starts out with the cat's name, which is Pangur. Pangur, white Pangur. I thought this was really beautiful.
Pangur, white Pangur, how happy we are alone together. Scholar and cat, each has his own work to do daily. For you it is hunting, for me study. Your shining eye watches the wall, my feeble eye is fixed on a book. You rejoice when your claws entrap a mouse. I rejoice when my mind fathoms a problem. Neither hinders the other, thus we live ever, without tedium and envy. Pangur, white Pangur, how happy we are alone together. Scholar and cat, Pangur, white Pangur, how happy we
I hope you heard that at the very end there. Isn't that sweet?
Oh, it's just lovely.
Yeah. And can't help thinking of our resident cat lover in our studio here. Yeah, that was Samuel Barber again. And part of a whole series of hermit songs. We have an instrumental piece called The Hermit, which we'll save to close out the show, I think. So you had some more thoughts about privacy.
Yes.
Jane.
Yeah. Here's something I dug up that I had written in 1987, just a few snippets here. About personal privacy or offering. I think offering privacy. Own your sorrow. Reveal it if and only if you wish. I will not compel you to share, nor shall I gaze upon a heart that seeks to face, at times, such things in solitude.
So that made me think of a contrasting approach. That's beautiful. Yeah. That's a very respectful attitude.
I think that's the idea of respect for someone's wishes, not to reveal or discuss. Or sometimes we get that pressure.
And then for other people, it doesn't take that pressure. They offer their personal stories, like it or not. And we're going to share just a tidbit of this song called Private Life. As a contrast to what Jane just shared. It has a few French words in there at the beginning of the line. The first line is repeated three times. Your private life drama, baby, leave me out. And then the next line is it means that I'm fed up or had enough with your theatrics. But we'll hear some of this here.
Anything official.
Okay, I think we get the point.
Who is that, Fran?
The Pretenders.
Performing that. Great.
Yeah, I don't know who wrote it, but
I wonder if Chrissy Hyde?
Could be. I don't know.
Oh, that was a great choice. I haven't heard that before.
Oh, yeah.
No.
Yep. So
another way of thinking about privacy.
Right.
Private life. Maybe don't bring it on.
Right.
Your private life. Yeah. That's
yeah. Good. Reversal of attitude from what you're expressing. What more might you have to contribute here?
Well, I found this thing that I had looked at many years ago. I took some notes on this. I read this book. It's by this Belgian who later became quite famous at the time, sculptor and writer, and his name is John Corse. And when he was a 12-year-old, he ran away from home. And again, he lived in Belgium. And he discovered a gypsy, a band of gypsies. I shouldn't call them a band, a caravan or a community of gypsies. And he'd go and visit them all the time and became friendly with them and got to know all the people. And they adopted him as a son. And here he is talking about just talking about an older woman whom he admired and got to know. And this, I thought, really tied in with what we're talking about today. Her voice had a honeyed quality, if slightly husky, and she spoke with hypnotic intensity. She said privacy in the first place was a state of mind. Perhaps the clever non-Romani erected walls to create secluded privacy. To the Romani, however, privacy was first of all a courtesy, extended and a restraint from the desire to pry or interfere in other people's lives. However, privacy must not be the result of indifference to others, but rather a mark of respect for them and of real compassion.
Yeah, very nice. Yeah, interesting.
And I have one more thing. May I add that now? These are
sure.
real things. Yeah, I really enjoyed this book. In fact, I forgot to tell you, it's from a book called The Gypsies. And I am sorry, I can't remember exactly when it was written, but the author is running away to be with the gypsies. I believe it was in the 40s. So that would tell you something. I had an experience back in, I guess it doesn't matter when, but I was thinking about intentional privacy and creating personal space, but how indifference and loneliness may be the outcomes of this. So the summer I chose to live in the wood tick, which was a tiny little shingle cabin covered with little bottle caps that spelled out the word wood tick. It had an outhouse and a little pump in the front yard. And I had quite a romanticized view of staying in this little place. I was there for about 5 months. Except for work at a restaurant nearby, I barely had social interaction with anyone. And I'm looking back on it, I think it was intentional. Other than solo walks in the national forest, I read a lot, wrote some, drew some, hung out with my new little kitten, Nia, but I was not very happy. I later saw this six-month period as a very lonely time and not particularly healthy. I had truly romanticized it. And I think about it positively, but in retrospect, this was not particularly healthy for me. Still, I did not regret the experience. Yes, I had sought privacy, freedom from interruptions, enabling focus. Actually, it was kind of unstimulating, not boring really, but just unstimulating being by myself this much. And I vowed that I would not intentionally separate myself from the world again. I needed friends. Now, that's a bit of an overstatement because I certainly am a person who does at times cherish privacy. But in this instance, I needed friends.
Yeah, it's a spectrum, all right, and so different people's where you're coming from and what your needs are and whether such an experience is totally good or bad.
Yeah, it's the time. What time is this happening during your life? It's so conditional.
Yeah. Yeah. When I was first living up where I am, which was seemed much more remote at the time, kind of like the hermit in Patrick's story, things have been getting built up around me. It still is, most people would consider it somewhat remote, but actually I've thought of this as a prompt for a whole other program about communication and telephone and how things have evolved from when we were still back in the little town that time forgot, and we had a phone on the wall that you picked up the receiver thing and talked to the operator, told her whom you wanted to talk to. And then anyway, fast forwarding to my first many years in the cabin in the woods, and there was no cell phone and no landline available. And the closest thing was an answering machine I had halfway into town, so 7 miles down the road. Some people let me put a box on the outside of their garage, and I wired a phone line, a landline into it with an answering machine. I'd stop there every day on my way home and see if I had any messages, and I could call out on it. And it did feel maybe a little excessively isolated at first. And what romanticized, people think it's wonderful to live without a phone. Well, if it's not, people can never get hold of you, they want to come up and visit, they can't let you know or anything like that. Anyway,
but it is interesting how we've changed completely in the opposite direction to some extent. You're considered antisocial if you aren't responding constantly with your phone or your device.
Yep. Well, we do have to draw this to a close here. We'll close out with the hermit song, but I will remind you that the prompt for the next episode is youthful mischief or things you never told your parents. And we would like responses to that one by Thursday, March 27th. And that works. That makes sense. And you're welcome to submit anonymously, and either in writing or a recorded voice memo from a smartphone, and send those to ktwhwriters@gmail.com. And so let's see if I can find the right one here. The Definitive Transatlantic Collection, John Renborn. This is his The Hermit. Nice instrumental piece here to go out on. Thank you.